My guest today was born in Queensland, Australia. After graduating as a lawyer, she left Australia, and since then she has lived in London, Hong Kong, Singapore, Tokyo, and New York. In New York, she completed her master's in creative writing, where she started to write her first book. She's now living in London, and today we're talking about it, The Wool Grower's Companion. It's her first novel, and she is Joy Rhodes. Hi, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thanks, Jasmine. It's great to be here.
So your book is about humans coping in a harsh climate, in a harsh world set in World War II in the outback. Where did you get the inspiration?
It was partly my childhood, because I grew up in a small country town in Western Queensland, very much like that, the harsh environment that you see in The Wool Grower's Companion, but also partly from my wonderful grandmother. So she spent most of her life on a wool place, a sheep place in northern New South Wales. And so I heard from her these wonderful stories, sometimes terrible, but mostly wonderful stories of life in the bush. And that's what I wanted to reflect on the page.
Fantastic. Racism against the Aborigines is a big theme in the book. Was your granny aware of this?
She was. I mean, I think anyone in the bush is conscious of their community. I think, though, there's no question that generationally Australians have changed. And that's not to say my granny was racist, but I think the way...
Attitudes
have changed a lot. And I think when I was writing the book, I very much wanted to reflect the reality of what life was like then as much and as best as I could.
But it's really quite shocking, because the statements like, you know, they call them those blackies and they think that they're unclean, you know, I mean, it really is really disturbing.
It is disturbing. And part of the research for me was, frankly, it made me ashamed, because I didn't realise, firstly, how little I knew, and also the circumstances. So I wanted to reflect that in the book. But at the end of the day, I wanted it to be a great story if I could possibly swing it. And so the historical research is there, and certainly I wanted to be respectful of those circumstances, but I hope very much it is not that's not the central message of the book. Like, I want the central message of the book really to be about hope for all races. I mean, that probably sounds a bit trite, but I do.
Fantastic. So the characters are as tough as the landscape. Can you tell us about some of them in the book?
So my favourite character is Kate, who is the main character, and she's certainly modelled to some extent on my grandmother. It's not my grandmother's story, but some of the toughness of country women, of bush women in Australia then and now, and that's always, in my experience, it's wrapped in a real gentleness and kindness and an ability to laugh, you know, a real sense of humour.
So you've got to have one.
You've got to have one. And so I wanted to I wanted Kate to reflect that. So I like Kate a lot, but I wanted to make Kate a woman of her time, and so that meant she had to be very constrained. She's a young woman, she's 23, and she's been raised to believe that she can't run a sheep place, that she can't do very much at all. She really has to run the house.
She's meant to be a lady, isn't
she? She's meant to be a lady.
Her mother is very aspiring, isn't she?
Very much so. And so what I wanted to reflect in the book is Kate's path, really, as she faces challenges, how she overcomes them, sometimes with the right decisions, sometimes not with the right decisions, just like all of us, but how she ultimately, I think, grows stronger throughout the book. So I like Kate very much, but I think she's probably frustrating because she is a woman of her time. And so for us now, when we have much greater agency, it's probably hard to imagine the constraints that she was under, but that's what I wanted to write about.
Exactly. Can you tell me about Kate's dad, as he's larger than life figure in her life, and he kind of does dominate the book somewhat?
He does. And again, Ralph, Kate's father, I wanted him to be a strong character. I make a point with my writing not to base one character on one person, so each character is always an amalgam, just as Kate is, and so it is with Ralph. But certainly there were many, you know, bush men that I knew growing up who were just like Ralph, big men physically and also in their personality. So Ralph is a soldier settler. And he's...
Can you tell us what that is?
So that after both wars, First and Second World War in Australia, the returning soldiers, if they applied, could be granted a small plot of land in an effort to, if you like, repay the debt that the country owed to those men who'd fought. The difficulty in both cases was that, unfortunately, the pieces of land issued were too small for people to make a living, and it wasn't realised at the time, and sadly the problem was repeated, the mistake was repeated in the Second War. But certainly Ralph is a World War One soldier settler. He's managed to survive because, frankly, I don't know whether I can swear on the podcast, but
yes,
he's a bit
can.
Of a bastard,
yes,
right? So, and so what he's done is he's taken advantage of his neighbours. And as the neighbours have struggled, he's helped them over the cliff, as it were. So he's dammed a creek to cut their water off and to ensure that he has got a solid and a reliable water supply. So it's those sorts of things that has given him a real name in the district for a hard man. But also, of course, he's a huge presence in Kate's life. And so Kate has to really manage him because he's falling ill as the book goes on.
Exactly. So it's the middle of nowhere. There's a drought on, a war on. Kate has lost her new husband to the war effort.
She has. So Kate is really quite alone in the sense that she's the only woman on the place apart from her Aboriginal domestic, as they were called at that time, Daisy. And Daisy is only 14, so she's really a girl. So Kate is by herself. Her mother has passed away a couple of years before. Now, just before her mother passed away, Kate was introduced to a convalescing soldier in the local town by her mother. And clearly her mother wanted to see Kate settled before she passed away. She was growing increasingly ill. And so Kate did love Doug, and they marry. But
they didn't know each other, though.
They didn't know each other very well. So I think it was very typical for sort of wartime romances, very quick. And so Kate is really, and also frankly, terribly inexperienced, for want of a better word. She has had a very sheltered life. So now she's slowly coming into her own in the sense that she's helping increasingly to it through sort of by hook or by crook to manage the farm as her father declines. And of course she's by herself. Her husband is away fighting. So she's finding that she can in fact take on things and do things. And that's a tension, because her husband is very much of the school of the time, which is she's not to do anything unless she's instructed to do it.
Yeah, and he's saying things like, let's move away and things. And she's terribly attached to her home, you know, in a emotional every way. But also, two prisoners of war arrive.
Two prisoners of war arrive, yeah. Exactly. So I wanted to show various aspects of racism. And the arrival of the Italian POWs into many communities in Australia was a great shock to those communities. And it seems incredible now, but it was the case. I think it was a combination of things. News was filtering back of the terrible treatment of the Allied prisoners at the hands of the Japanese Imperial Army in places like Singapore. And so that news meant that it was very difficult for families whose sons were, POWs in Singapore, for example, to cope with the fact that here were Italian POWs working unguarded on local farming.
Untreated quite well.
Weren't the
Italians now on our side? They'd turned into allies.
They had turned into allies. Of course, in the middle of 43, Italy changed sides, but it really was a sleight of hand in the sense that rather than release those POWs, Winston Churchill decided that because they were desperately needed to fulfil labour, he kept them as there was a phrase which will come back to me in a second, but
like a bartering tool,
sort of. Yeah. And so the Italians, understandably, were very annoyed because they were still in prisoner of war camps for many, many months and sometimes years. So they were released, the enlisted men only, and non-fascists, of course. So, but they were released to be labourers in essential industries, and wool growing was an essential industry for uniforms. So Kate is dealing with these two young men who are battle scarred to a large extent, one of them less than the other, both captured in North Africa, and both having spent years in prisoner of war camps. First, sort of on their way, they spent time in India and then were shipped out to Australia as the burden of trying to take care of these POWs was spread around what was then really the end of the empire.
But then I thought, interestingly, I'll just go to the end of the book, some of them kind of repatriated, or the word is, they became Australians.
Absolutely. So while all of them had to be shipped home under the Geneva Convention, even if they wanted to stay, it's difficult to tell, but it looks like about 5% of them did come back to Australia as immigrants, and they were sponsored. And in fact, my grandmother and her father sponsored two families to come back to Australia.
Lovely.
Yeah. So, and then, so nice. You know, very great fondness, I think, on both sides, really. Yeah,
especially the cooking, which comes in, of course, to the book. Now, let's talk about the stars of the book, which obviously are the sheep. I mean, you know, because it is the Will Groats Companion. And they are, you know, they're vital to everyone's lives. Obviously, they're not Indigenous sheep. How did they get their merinos, which sounds Italian to me, again, more Italian immigrants, and how do they cope in the heat? And tell us about the name Will Groats Companion as well.
So the sheep are absolutely central to the book, and merino, of course, is advertisement. The Australian wool girls will be happy with me, but it is the finest wool, right? The world's finest wool, super fine wool. And Australia, for many decades, rode on the sheep's back, and that enormous value, the wool crop, every year really paved the way to a lot of Australia's wealth in the early part of the 20th century, and right up to the middle, really. Where I set the book in northern New South Wales is very much sheep growing country. Now, the merinos themselves apparently originally came from Spain, and they came out at around about, they think, very, very early on after white settlement, and they thrived. Now, whether it was because the tough conditions, they were well suited already and they were just fine, kind of thing, but certainly the one thing perhaps that I don't really address directly in the book, but which is a fact, is they've done enormous environmental damage because and cattle.
Because of the way they nibble or something.
Well, both nibbling and also their hooves. They break the ecocycle effectively because they ruin the grasses, and then the entire system kind of slowly breaks down. So that is an environmental issue that Australia is grappling with. Having said that, the wool is beautiful. So somewhere in there.
And is it still as big then as it was then?
It is. It doesn't contribute the same amount proportionally to our GDP, but it's still enormous, enormous industry. And country people, it's romanticised that life, but certainly growing up, what I saw, and I was a town girl, and since my mum and dad had the local John Deere dealership, but it's a tough, tough life, you know, that any kind of farming life. And I think sometimes it's easy to romanticize it as you're at one with the country often, and I think often farmers are, they very much care about their land, but I think it's tough, very tough life.
And the name The Will Groats Companion, can you tell me about that book?
It's funny, I love Victorian literature, and so at the start of each chapter, what I've done is I've written myself a guide to sheep growing, but I've written it as if I were a Victorian sheep man. And it came to me one day. I was actually literally walking along the street in London, and I thought, it occurred to me that I could probably, in a quote about sheep growing, talk about things that I could never talk about directly in the book. So I could talk about breeding and race and certain character traits and strengths and all sorts of things. And also, I'm a great fan of that wonderful, wonderful book, The Shipping News. And of course, at the beginning of each chapter is a quote from a real book, the Book of Knots, the nautical knots, and it's that terrific tying of the content of the chapter to that knot, which I was just so in awe of. So I thought, gosh, you know, that's what I can do. So that's what I've done, and I've taken all my new knowledge of sheep, because I have learned a lot about sheep in the writing of the book, with a lot of help from real sheep people, and I've aligned that with my love of Victorian literature, and so I've written in that wonderful, complex and formal Victorian language.
I honestly thought it was real.
Oh, that's great, and you're not the first. A lot of people have. So that's, I'm thrilled, right?
Might have to bring out the real book.
And actually at a reading in Australia, a lovely gentleman brought me a book from the 1920s, A Drover's Guide, which he said, you know, is this where you got it? And I'm like, no, absolutely. So it's so clearly they existed, which makes complete sense. Yeah. But no, it was great fun to write. And I did learn a lot about sheep. And some of it we've learned quite recently. And so I'm sure a very eagle-eyed sheep person will pick up that some of it is anachronistic. But it was great fun to write. And it did enable me to bring out aspects of the book that I wouldn't have been able to directly.
Now let's talk about the flora, the fauna and the actual wildlife in Australia, like the kookaburras. You know, they're obviously always, because it's a very kind of visual book, I'm always imagining the birds, the way you wrote it.
Oh, isn't that lovely? So I wrote, I think as you mentioned it in the introduction, I wrote it all from outside Australia. So it is very much a love letter to Australia. And I did grow up in the bush, and I think many, many Australians, whether that you grew up in the bush or not, feel that very visceral connection to the environment. So I wanted readers to hear the birds and see the dust in the air and smell the dirt after rain, that kind of thing. So I'm so glad you feel that way. I mean, it was funny. I was very lucky. YouTube, God bless YouTube, because I was able to listen again to bird calls.
Wonderful.
And think, yeah, that's what it, because, you know, I remembered a whipbird, but really, how does it sound, that sort of thing? And I spoke to my father, who's a great bird person, and talked to him about, now, wait a minute, would it have been, does that kind of bird exist in northern New South Wales?
Yeah,
got to get it right. So it was, and other friends who are bird people too. So it was a lovely experience, really.
Oh. So food and drink are mentioned many times in the book. The kettle is always on, the tea is always brewing, and they're eating Anzac biscuits, bickies, and scones. Tell us about food, because the food sounded, even though I didn't recognise some of the names, it sounded so English.
Well, you know, I think it was at that time. Certainly my research tended to indicate that it was very plain food, good food, a lot of
English,
it. Yeah, really.
Was then.
And,
very
it, you know, to give you a sense, my father, even now, really doesn't like pasta, because his vision of pasta is he used to see it drying on fences on the place as a little boy. So the Italians would make it, hang it on the fences to dry. And he always felt it was, you know, I guess he sort of saw it as the food of prisoners, if you see what I mean. Yeah. Like they weren't.
Or peasants' food.
Well, well, they weren't viewed as prisoners, but at the end of the day, it was this something.
Yeah. Also, it's not meat and two veg.
No,
exactly.
Come
on.
Well, it was Australia. We had three veg, right?
Three veg.
So, but it was. It was funny. It was a remarkable experience to go into that research around the food. Actually, the wonderful Country Women's Association in Australia was hugely helpful, and I was able to look at some of their cookbooks, which go back decades and decades and decades, and frankly, still have amazing recipes. So I actually have, with their approval, I've added some of their, I think the recipes are actually from, it's not spot on 1945 when the book is written. I think they might have set, rather, I think it's not, it might be 1946, but it amazed me the kinds of suggestions they would have, you know, for literally how to dress a bullock. And you're like, wow.
What?
Clearly they were dealing with women in very remote areas having to do all kinds of things.
Kind of butchery.
Butchering would have been done, but then how do you actually
handle
all that meat?
How do you cook a cow's head?
Yes, sort of. So luckily I don't ever have to deal with that.
Tell us about Anzac biscuits.
Anzac biscuits. So
sounds like from South America.
It does, doesn't it? So they historically, of course, they were meant to be the bickies that the soldiers took with them to the front lines, mainly because they were hard and they lasted a long time. I do talk about Anzac Day a little bit in the book. Of course, the thing that shocked me was to discover that Indigenous servicemen were not permitted to march along with other Australians on Anzac Day.
What is Anzac Day?
So Anzac Day is effectively, excuse me, like our Remembrance Day.
Yeah.
And so April 25th every year, I remember as a brownie and as a guide marching with the soldiers, the returned soldiers, and there was a dawn service and there was an 11 o'clock service.
So it's like our November the 11th.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But the thing that shocked me was that the Indigenous servicemen, in fact, there were, of course, Indigenous servicemen, were not, literally, not permitted to march. It wasn't even, there was a prohibition. So I wanted to include that that piece of history in the book. And it was those sorts of things which were so eye-opening for me. I mean, I think the good thing is Australia is very much changing, and so what is taught to children is so much more accurate. And we, I hope, are really coming out of that era.
Do you think there's guilt now or surrounding?
I'm sure so. I'm sure so, because I think as we learn, it's inevitable. Inevitable. I mean, I really hope that it's not even a question of hope. There are such strong Aboriginal voices and leaders, and that to me is everything. So we can receive guidance, we can listen. When I say we, the non-Indigenous Australians, so people
and
like...
Are they integrated now with society?
I mean, I think that's really a question for Aboriginal people. It's objectively there is so much that needs to be done.
Do you see them around? Do you see them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
I've never been to Australia, so I don't know.
Oh, okay. So it's relative to, say, African Americans, I believe the percentage of Australian people who identify as Indigenous is around 3 or 4%. So it's much smaller relatively than, say, people who identify as people of colour in the States, or rather as African Americans. But certainly I say I'm hugely heartened. So there are people like Rich Weston from the Healing Foundation, or Bronwyn Fredericks from the University of Queensland. There, Anita Heiss, author. That's just one of a gazillion Aboriginal leaders who are, I think, showing the way. I think it's a wonderful thing. So that there is a real strength and depth in Aboriginal leadership. Clinton Pryor, this remarkable young man who is walking across Australia to draw attention to Indigenous rights, all funded, grassroots funded, paying for his accommodation and his food and his shoes, walking through, heat that's up to 45, 50 degrees Celsius, incredible. So I do think there is a real movement, and I hope that we are moving to a better place. I really do.
Exactly. So your grandmother, I imagine, is not around anymore because we are a bit older. Would she be proud of this book?
I hope so. I hope so. So Granny passed away at 103, bless her.
Wow.
Yeah.
So not long ago.
No. So she knew I was writing. She, and she... She was very proud of family in the sense that she believed in family, very firmly in family. And when she did pass away, we had a wonderful memorial service, and it was terrific for me to see how many lives she touched. So how many members of the extended family had a strong and sort of affectionate view of her. It was remarkable. So that was a wonderful thing. I hope she would. She had the views of her generation. So I'm sure she would have said, "Oh dear, that would never have happened."
You know, shocked. Parts.
Yeah. Yeah, but she was essentially one of the kindest people I knew. So I think that for me, I hope we see in Kate.
Thank you, Joy. So The World Grows Companion is published by Vintage, and it's an imprint of Chatto and Windus. For more extraordinary women, go to radiogorgeous.com. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure, Josephine. Thanks again.